Education reform during the past two decades has focused on setting academic standards, testing, and school choice. So how have those reforms affected curriculum and the ways teachers teach? And have they been successful in boosting student achievement? Joining us in our Woods Hole studios to talk about education reform, Carol Woodbury, Superintendent of Schools at the Dennis Yarmouth Regional School District. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning.
Also, Barbara Cotton, Educator and Executive Director at the Cape Cod Children's Museum in Mashpee. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning.
And joining us on the phone from the Cape Cod Lighthouse Charter School and Executive Director of that school, Paul Niles. Are you there, Paul?
Good morning, John.
Good morning to you. Let's start by, I'd like to give our listeners a sense of who you are and what you do. You come from different areas of education. So, Kara, maybe I can start with you. You're the superintendent of the Dennis Yarmouth School District. Talk about that job a little bit.
It's kind of the question everybody asks. What does the superintendent do? I say other duties as assigned. But really, we're really in charge of an entire district, children from pre-K to 12, and all of the curriculum, their meals that they get at school, busing, you name it. We're in charge of it all, really. I've been in education all my life. I've worked at many different levels of education, elementary, middle, and high school. I've worked in special education, and I've taught kindergarten and first grade. Even got to teach woodworking once.
Oh, my. And Barbara Cotton, talk about your job in the world of education.
Well, I have probably one of the most fun jobs as the executive director of the Cape Cod Children's Museum. I get a chance to work with a wonderful staff. I get to work with the community. And basically, we gear all of what we do towards children and families. And that is our mission, to bring them together. And what we do isn't just child's play. It really is work. It's the work of childhood.
And Paul Niles, talk about being executive director of a charter school.
Sure, I would challenge Barbara and say that my job's got to be at least as fun as hers. So I was one of the founding teachers of the Lighthouse Charter School 19 years ago, and I took over as executive director after many years of being associate director and also the eighth grade science teacher. So I'm sort of like the superintendent and the principal, and my one demand in taking over the executive directorship was that I still get to teach eighth grade science half-time. How can one person do this? Well, obviously, one person doesn't. We've got a very collaborative style of management, site-based management. But essentially, we run an innovative middle school for students, 240 students in grades 6 through 8.
Well, let's start by taking a look back. When it comes to education reform, we can look to 1988 with the National Assessment of Educational Programs, and then 1995, President Clinton's Goals 2000 Act, and then in 2001, Bush's No Child Left Behind, and most recently, 2009, the Race to the Top. Lots of reform efforts, big pushes to align curriculum and assessments and professional development, as we were saying. But where does this leave us? Carol Woodbury, maybe you can start. Talk about the differences in the classroom now compared to, say, when those first reform efforts were beginning in 1988?
Well, I think all of the reform efforts are always opportunities, if you will, to align what's going on in schools with what's happening in the world. I'd like to just give you a quick quote from a book called 16 Trends. It says, "A funny thing happened on the way to accomplishing our plan. The world changed." And so one of the things that I always think about a lot is that we're preparing our students for the world they're going to live in, not the world that we grew up in, so to speak. So when we're looking at all of these different changes, one of the things that we want to be really conscious of is what's happening in the world, how are things changing, what kinds of jobs will our students be able to have, and what kind of skills do they need. One of the things that Paul mentioned a little while ago was innovation. And one of the things that I think that we have to think a lot about is that what are those kind of skills that people will need for their future? They're not necessarily memorization and that kind of thing. It's things like creative problem solving, being able to take a problem and work it through and persevere through challenges and things like that. So there are a lot of what people might consider soft skills that are really more important than the actual knowledge that you have. So it's kind of on more, I think, on the skill side these days. And we have all kinds of technology tools. We can look up information. It's right here in our hand. We have we're all walking around with computers in our hands. We don't need to memorize everything. Not that there's not some room for memorization. That's a good skill, too. But knowing how to solve problems, being able to think critically and creatively, being able to make judgments of things when you're presented with information. How do you decide whether this is good or bad? I think those are the kinds of skills that we're trying to have our students end up with so that they can be successful.
Paul Niles, your impression, it seems we're constantly hearing about new education reform efforts. You know, are these renewed efforts with seemingly each new administration helpful? And again, where are we kind of now?
Well, I agree with Carol that the focus is really on skills, 21st century skills, problem-solving skills, skills that require one to work with technology to use information rather than to memorize the information. And I would contend that this stream really has existed for the last 20 years or so that our school has been in existence. So although some of the details change, our goal at the Lighthouse Charter School, and I know that it's a goal in many schools, in most schools these days, is to develop creative, problem-solved, thinking, global citizens who can use technology to solve problems. And that really hasn't changed. Sometimes the technology changes, sometimes the kinds of problems that we're focusing on changes. So in my view, it's important to look at the big, deep themes in education. And I think those have remained the same. So how do you respond to that? Well, I think that context-rich, project-based problem-solving work that's interdisciplinary and that goes beyond the walls of just the school setting is a timeless theme to education. And I think that we need to be really creative in using the factual information that we have to teach in the Common Core and in the next generation science standards to develop those context-rich project work experiences for kids. It used to be enough to just give kids really cool experiences 20 or so years ago, but now those experiences have to be really much more carefully crafted to meet the high demands of the Common Core and the next generation science standards. And I think that's all a good thing. I think what goes wrong in some places is some places interpret the standardized testing culture to mean that systems have to narrow the curriculum and only focus on the content in those standardized tests. And I think that's a mistake.
And I definitely want to talk about standardized testing. Barbara Cotton of the Cape Cod Children's Museum, talk about the role that the museum has in tandem with what's happening in the classroom.
Well, it's very interesting. We focus primarily on the early childhood education. It is primarily for infants through about age 10. Our museum serves 50,000 annual visitors, and we really work collaboratively with all of these initiatives. You know, Paul did bring up a really good point that, you know, some of the things that we're doing educationally, they need to be thoughtful, and that's where the Children's Museum comes in. We look at what we're doing and how do we make each child's experience a thoughtful one. And one of the initiatives, again, when we're looking at something like STEM, and we really probably should talk about that today, the science, technology, engineering, and math, there are initiatives even at the preschool level. And although people may counter that you're trying to bring these concepts to children that are too young to embrace them, when you break it down and you look at what these initiatives are doing, they're kind of the standard things that have been going on for years. And so when Paul mentioned, you know, the last 20 years, some of the initiatives don't really change. We change the name, we kind of change the approach, but the basics are the same. So when you're looking at things like curiosity, initiatives, solving problems, focusing children's attention and persistence, those are things that we're looking for in a strong workforce, but they're also skills that we really want to help children of a very young age to develop and focus on. And we can do that through play. Play is the fun work of childhood. childhood, and sometimes that debt's underestimated. Parents are too busy today to focus on play. We think about it not as work but as fun. But when we do focus on the fact that children learn so much through play, it's something that's missed when we don't spend some time on it.
We're talking about education here on The Point. And if you have a question or a comment, we really invite you to be part of the conversation. 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Or you can always email thepoint@wgbh.org. And Paul Niles, you know, education reform, one of the efforts was to really give students choices. And out of that, we have one of the things we have is charter schools. Talk about charter schools and how they add to the educational landscape and opportunities.
Sure. One of the great things about charter schools is that they did help to introduce choice into our landscape. And that allows those who are designing charter schools to develop an educational niche that can allow them to create a mission and to create an approach that's slightly different than the typical public school. And one of the great things that I've seen happen in the last 20 years is that as choice has opened up on Cape Cod and beyond, other schools are developing their own niches and looking closely at their mission statements and how they deliver education. I think Carol at DY has done a really good job at looking at their system internally and really thinking hard at what they're good at and what they need to improve at. We do that every year at our school. And so Ken Jenks, the principal from DY, comes in every year and gives presentations to our kids to try to present the strengths of their system. And I think that kind of systematic introspection is important in any successful enterprise. If you're running a business and you don't do some introspection on what's working and what's not, then your business won't be successful for very long. Mm-hmm. So in the era when typical public schools had monopolies, they didn't necessarily have to run that kind of introspective cycle. And so I think that's one thing that charter schools have done well. And another is we are free within limits to experiment with educational methodology as long as our kids are scoring well on the MCAS tests and our school is meeting all of the intense assessment criteria that the state puts out there. So I feel like opening up education to a more entrepreneurial model has made us all better, and I feel like we're lucky to be on Cape Cod, a place where we have magnificent school systems dotting the entire landscape.
Carol Woodbury, there was a lot of concern, consternation about the arrival of charter schools and even school choice, allowing students to go from one district to another. But that may be changing, but where do you think we are now? Was all that concern necessary, or do you think it's kind of worked out? What do you think?
I don't know if the concern was necessary. I wasn't here when the schools here started, so I can't really answer anything about that. I think that the biggest concern from the public school side, and I realize that most charter schools are public charter schools, but from the traditional, I'll say the traditional school district side, is that everybody needs to be playing by the same rules. Because if you're not playing by the same rules, then the playing field's not level, and therefore you have different challenges. One of the things that I talk about a lot, I'm in a regional district. I have a school committee that I answer to. I have two finance committees, one in each town. I have two boards of selectmen and two town meetings to get my budget through. The difference between my process and the process that a charter school has to go through is that there are no local budget meetings that the charter has to go through to get its budget passed. Mm. And so I don't personally feel like that's a level playing field, but I don't wallow in that. I do what mm-hmm. I need to do and move on. I think many of the things that Paul said are very true. I think that for a long time, it's quite possible that schools were complacent and maybe not taking a strong look at themselves. And I think that's important. He brings up a very good point. But we weren't trained to do that initially. And so did we need this to shock us into it? I don't know. But it is a good thing.
Well, change is always very difficult. We're going to take a quick 1 minute break. And when we come back, we will talk about standards and student achievement. We'll be back. And we're talking about education with Kara Woodbury, the superintendent of schools at the Dennis Yarmouth Regional School District, Barbara Cotton, educator and executive director at the Cape Cod Children's Museum in Mashpee, and Paul Niles, the executive director of Cape Cod Lighthouse Charter School. Paul, let's talk about standards. So the Massachusetts Department of Education has developed state standards for student achievement. Now, those apply to charter schools, public schools, private schools as well. How do those standards work?
So they do not apply to public to private schools, but they do apply to charter schools because we are public schools. So our kids do have to take the MCAS test, and soon they'll have to take the replacement for the MCAS test, which is the PARC assessment. So we are responsible for that, and we do have a very intense assessment cycle. So if our students don't do well on those tests, then they can close us down. Which I think is appropriate, which I think is a great challenge. So we have the challenge of teaching well to those standards, but also teaching to the mission elements that we feel go beyond those standards. So the goal of the new PARC assessments are going to be to create students that are college and career ready, and those are laudable goals. And we've got the new Common Core curriculum standards that will be used to measure whether students have that readiness. But we have a larger goal of wanting to create global citizens who are adept problem solvers. And so that requires, we believe, more than just teaching to the standards. So we work really hard on student character development, and creating context-rich problem-solving projects that create systems thinking in our students. So we really feel strongly that we need to go beyond those standards and create students who are going to be the leaders for the next generation. Look, here we are in Massachusetts, a place where our students score better than students all around the rest of the country. Our students stack up to students all around the world. When Massachusetts counted itself as a country 1 year, paid a little extra money, our students, our eighth graders, scored first in the world in science and second in the world in math. We're at the top of education, so we are developing the leaders for the next generation, and we've got to go beyond these standards. We can't be hemmed in by just what the standards say we need to teach kids.
Kara Woodbury, you see those standards as a minimum as well? And maybe you can give an example of an academic standard that has to be met, and what happens if it isn't met? I know pulling those out of the air can be very difficult. But
yeah, I'm not even going to try.
Okay.
yeah, I totally agree with what Paul is saying. Those standards are minimum standards, and what we're trying to do is really prepare our children to be global citizens, as he indicated. One of the things that we have been doing in our district is that we have been working really in the world. You know that there are many global businesses today that do business throughout the country and the world. And one of the things that's really important is that our students learn to work with people of other cultures. So we're part of a program called GTEC, which is a Global Technology Engineering Consortium. It's out of Olin College. I think we're the only public school district that's involved with it. And we've been using this program at the high school. It's going to move to the middle school this year. To give you an example, our students at the high school may be doing water quality tests in the town of Yarmouth. And some students over in Russia are doing water quality tests, similar water quality tests on the water in their community. And then the students are getting together via Skype and other kinds of technology tools to compare results and to talk about impacts and those sorts of things. That's just one example. But I think that having these sort of global experiences, and one of the other things that we're very concerned about is that children learn other languages.
Right.
If I had the opportunity to go to Finland last year and Sweden, children in other parts of the world are learning 2 and 3 languages. And we're really behind in that because we're, forgive me, but a little bit snobbish about everybody learning English. And that's a good thing. We do need to all speak English. But every language that a child learns is a window into the world. So they learn not only to speak the language, but they learn about the culture. And in order to be successful in a global society, you have to understand other people. I think Paul mentioned collaboration. It's difficult to collaborate globally if you don't understand something about the other people that you're working with. So collaboration with right within the classroom and beyond. And I think, Barbara, you mentioned STEM, certainly a major piece today, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. At DY, we like to call it STEAM because we throw the little A in there because we don't want to forget the arts. One of the things that is the pride of DY is both the performing and visual arts. And we encourage kids to do that. We start with our preschoolers and kindergartners all the way up through. We have pre-K to 3 schools that kids start in the arts early. One of our schools, the kids are even learning ukuleles. Mm-hmm. We started steel drums last year at the middle school. This year we're going to be offering bagpipes at our high school and all the other traditional kinds of music things. And when you're talking about being problem solvers and team members and working collaboratively and all of that, there's nothing like an orchestra performance or some kind of band performance or choral performance to watch that in action. So, yes, minimum standards.
Barbara Cotton, standards in what you do at the Children's Museum?
Well, it's funny because Carol said STEAM, and I would even contend to call it STREAM because we at the Children's Museum like that literacy component, so we put the reading in there as well. Why not? We keep piggybacking
sure.
on all of these things.
I love
things.
Acronyms. Go ahead.
You know, the standards are always going to be really important, and even for a Children's Museum, and I think this is what a lot of people don't understand, Children's Museums are not play places in the sense of like a drop-off and you just let your kids kind of run around for a few hours and you leave. They really are different than those kinds of play places. They call for parents to really interact with their child. And the parents who get that are the ones that are active on the floor with those children, engaging them in all of these kinds of standards that we are looking for as a child progresses through their educational experience. So if we're looking for curiosity and initiative and problem solving and focusing their attention and persistence, those things start with the toys. And it starts with a parent asking a question when they're playing peekaboo. Where did mommy go? Where did daddy go? Where did the ball go? The Bernoulli exhibit, when it goes up, what makes it float? What happens when the airstream stops? Starting to ask those questions really starts to get to the curiosity of a child. So these things are not too young to approach with a toddler or an early childhood a child of an early age.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about children of early age. Paul Niles, with pressures for meeting standards coming in at earlier and earlier ages, we've seen ramped up expectations, including overtly academic work and in kindergarten. And so how has this approach to early education changed, and do you think we're pushing kids too early now?
Students are amazed that we still have recess here at our middle school.
I think
Barbara and early educators are really on to something with the focus on play. The more that these kinds of problem-solving projects that we have students engage in, the more that they're like play, the better designed I think that they are. Let me give an example of a tough standard that a student of ours was having a hard time meeting, an eighth-grade data analysis standard about making scatter plots and interpreting the slope line from that scatter plot. We had a student who was really having difficulty understanding that in the standard set of lessons. And so we have a capstone project called our Body Biology Project, where students study some aspect of their body's functioning for a month. And they've got to ask questions, as Barbara talked about, the importance of asking fundamental questions. And then they've got to design an approach to answering those questions. So this student was running a mile for a month and was measuring her times and measuring different biometric responses to that running, her heart rate response, her maximum heart rate, how long it took for the heart rate to come down. And as she was doing her data analysis for this project in class, I saw her tear up a little bit. And I went over and said, what's wrong? And she said, oh, my gosh, the slope for my scatter plot was only negative 1.1, which means that I only improved on by an average of this much time each day. And it wasn't until she had this experience of working with this data, which to her was like play, going out and running for the course of a month, that she was able to understand what the slope of that scatter plot really meant. And I asked her, I said, okay, well, if you're not satisfied with that, let me ask you this. Can you extrapolate and tell me how long, if you improve at this rate continually, how long it will take you to break the world record for the mile? And so she did that, and she said, oh, my gosh, I'm gonna have the world record for the mile in 1 year. And then that led to another lesson on improvement rates and physiology and how you can't continue to improve at that rate. But she really understood slopes and scatter plots by that experience, which was almost like play to her.
Well, Carol, is there flexibility in the system of standards and testing to encourage students to learn at their own pace and in their own way? And if there's not, should there be?
I think we've always had that. I think we need to trust in our teachers in many ways. They know how to make that stuff come alive. And one of the things that I make abundantly clear at DY is that we're not here to practice MCAS. Mm. That's not why kids come to school. And I think if the message from whoever's in charge is something like that, I think you can get to a lot of places. At DY, we have instituted for our kindergarten programs. Barbara, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's called Tools of the Mind. And we specifically chose that over other kinds of accreditation processes that we could have because of the curriculum that's involved, that involves things like dramatization and kids listening to literature and those kinds of things that are involved with play that should be a part of every kindergarten. We're very excited that in one of our innovation schools, we were able to increase the time that children have physical activity. We're paying attention to things like farm to school. We have a farm to school grant, and we're planting gardens and then bringing the food into the school, and the cafeteria folks are helping our kids prepare it and try it. So all of those things enhance. I mean, there are pieces of the Common Core standards that absolutely have to do with, you know, photosynthesis and all those kinds of science things that you've always learned. But we're learning it in a fun, hands-on kind of way. It's not drill and kill. I don't really think if the standards are strong that you can drill and kill. I think you have to, it's something that builds upon itself year after year after year. And I think that one of the things we talked about before, all schools have always had the opportunity to innovate. They just haven't thought about it. And so while we have some of this choice and competition, it's led to a lot of innovation. And I think that that has helped us to think beyond just the foundation of the standards. That's there. That's the floor. But it's not the ceiling.
Mm-hmm. And Barbara, at the museum, are you speaking with the schools? Are you aware of the different requirements that they have and try to supplement the education?
We are. I did want to respond to what Carol had said, too. You know, in terms of the imaginative play, the really cool thing about what children's museums do is that interactive piece fosters their imagination. So we have exhibits that are smaller versions of life, real life things. But when a child comes to approach the play, there's no right or wrong. And so they can make a purple cow. They could be cooking something that is not what you would normally eat. But again, it's okay for them to come up with something different. And I think that helps to foster that imagination that we're looking for, that there doesn't have to be one right answer for something. And we celebrate that. I think once a child reaches a certain age in school, there's only one right answer. It has to be done a certain way. Your grass always has to be green. Your cow always has to be white with brown. And so I think that what we try to do is to explore that part. To speak about what you had asked about collaborating with schools, yes, we are. Children's museums have actually taken off in the last 10 years. There's been an increase in the number of children's museums. And what they're finding is that the importance of what we're doing is validated. Mm. And when we look at what we're doing, things like STEM help to support that. The schools right now with Mashpee Public Schools, we're working collaboratively with them to actually try to enhance the Countdown to Kindergarten program. And we're working on exploring grants for that. We would like to be able to pilot an enhanced Countdown to Kindergarten program. In fact, the Boston Children's Museum is launching theirs tonight, Mayor Menino, and I think it's their 17th annual. And so schools have adapted something like a Countdown to Kindergarten where they celebrate kids going off to school. We're looking at saying, gee, can we bring an academic piece to that to help the kids really hit the ground running? What we're finding with the economics especially, and I know schools are struggling with this too, is kids are coming in significantly more challenged. We see at the Children's Museum an increase in this last year, despite the economy, despite people saying we don't have money to spend on some of these resources. What we're able to provide as a nonprofit is a rich resource, and parents can come and enjoy creative movement and yoga, things that they would have to pay to do elsewhere are included with their membership or with their admission. And so what we're doing is helping to build a foundation for that and supporting what the schools are already doing. So when they can come and enjoy that at no extra cost, that's huge for our community. And so when we look and we say, how can we support what the schools are already doing for parents who are already challenged economically? Again, preschool, to speak to that. Some of our kids are not getting a formal preschool experience. Economics are defying that. We see an increase in grandparents visiting, they're caretaking their grandchildren. And the finances are such with a two-income family that mom's not able to have that interactive time or the means to be able to afford preschool. So what kinds of things can we have at the museum? We have open play opportunities, but we also have thoughtful, engaging programs that bring all of these things to the forefront.
We got a question. We were talking about school choice in Massachusetts, how you can send your child to a school outside your community or to a charter school. Carol, just quickly on this, they wanted some clarity on that. How does school choice impact funding of school districts, and does it set up competition among schools? That was what the question was from a listener.
It depends on what if your child is choosing to go to another school district, regular public school. Child went from Mashpee to DY or vice versa. The state has set up a specific amount. I think it's $5,000 or $6,000 per student that follows the child, and you just go to that school if they have room for you. Mm-hmm. You sign up and you take your child to that school. That's just the way it works. With the charter schools, also there's a funding mechanism. I believe it's the full per pupil expenditure. So, for example, if DY's per pupil expenditure was $12,000 a student and a child chose to go from DY to Lighthouse, that full $12,000 would follow the child.
Paul Niles, that sounds right to you? Anything to add?
That's pretty close to right, yes. The other piece in there is that in order to allow systems that lose students to charter schools, the school that loses the student does get reimbursed that first year. Also for the students, so that they can plan forward, and then the second year they get 50% reimbursement, and the third year I think they get 25% reimbursement, so they don't lose all of the money right away. I will just say this about the budget process. I know Carol talked about having to meet with multiple school committees. I would trade that process anytime, because what traditional public schools get to do is to set their own budget and then meet with the towns to pass that budget, whereas we don't really get to set our own income. It's dependent upon the per pupil expenditures of our sending towns. So, and that's not even set in stone until the very end of the year, until their budgets become actual budgets. So, for example, last year I didn't even know my budget for last fiscal year until we got our last payment, which came in early June. So, you know, every system has its own pluses and minuses.
Carol, you want to add something?
Yeah. It would be another whole show.
Okay. Well, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will talk about standardized testing in the MCAS. We're talking about education with Carol Woodbury, the superintendent of schools at the Dennis Yarmouth Regional School District, Barbara Cotton, educator and executive director at the Cape Cod Children's Museum in Mashpee, and Paul Niles, the executive director of Cape Cod Lighthouse Charter School. When I first started off reporting MCAS was all I felt like I was writing about each and every week. Extremely controversial. People were very concerned that students wouldn't be able to graduate and that new MCAS tests would be coming on, and that, as we've said earlier, people would be simply teaching to the test. It seems from this conversation that hasn't necessarily been the case, at least not at this point. But so where do we stand with MCAS now? It's been around for 15 plus years. What's the reality with MCAS?
Well, obviously, the students take MCAS every year. We pay attention to it. We look at it. We look at the results. We look at where they did well, where they didn't do well. But, you know, that's just one measure.
But do you think that's where parents are looking at it? When they're deciding where they want to bring their kids to school, do you think they look into the MCAS to make that decision?
I think parents want their children to have a good, well-rounded education. I think the academic piece is certainly critically important if they're going to be successful in their future. But it's not necessarily the school per se that, you know, I don't know if you can draw a straight line from, you know, this child didn't do well on the MCAS, this is a bad school.
Or a bad teacher.
Right, exactly.
Right.
It's because it's just one measure, and it's one measure in time. And we always talk about it, it's kind of like getting forensic data. It's after everything has happened. And so you can look back and you can say, you know, I really emphasized multiplication of fractions last year, and look at, my kids did really well, or gosh, I emphasized that and they didn't do as well. I wonder why. And it's that same kind of questioning that we're hoping for our kids to do. Our staff has to do that too. But we need measures that take place along the way. Hmm. And one of the things that we're kind of looking forward to in some ways is that Park sort of promises to be a little bit more like that, where there might be some measurements along the way. Clearly, internally, districts are doing what they might call common assessments, a little educational jargon. But all that means is that if the three of us or four of us here were teaching the same grade level or the same content, we'd put together a little assessment, we'd give it to everybody that we teach, and we'd see how they did. And then we'd come back together and say, well, they seem to be struggling with this concept or this skill or whatever. And so, gee, you seem to have a good idea about how to do that. Your kids did really well. What did you do? Tell me more about that. So the collaboration of teachers is really critical these days. It's some of this has forced the doors to fly open and people to be much more willing to help one another and that sort of thing. But I don't think that you know, we look at MCAS as one measure, and you can't negate kids, the amount of kids going off to college, your dropout rates going down. And that's one of the things that people don't think about oftentimes, is that how different the world is today. When we say all children, we mean all children. The world has changed. A lot of manufacturing, low-level manufacturing jobs are gone. Lots of kids, more kids than ever before, need education beyond high school. That's what we're preparing them for. That didn't have to happen when we were growing up.
Mm, right. Paul Niles, the Cape Cod Lighthouse Charter Schools, all charter schools take the MCAS exam. You were explaining that earlier. Now we have Race to the Top, and it's the Park test that's coming out of Race to the Top, correct?
That's correct.
So what are you anticipating from this new testing mandate, and what do you think will happen here?
Well, one piece is that the Park test is going to be more technology-based, so kids will take it on computers. One hope that we're not sure whether it will be borne out is that there will be more of the kinds of creative thinking and process-based kinds of questions that are harder to do on a paper and pencil test that will, as Barbara likes to talk about, might have more than one right answer, more than one right pathway. So we're hoping that that can be part of the PARC test. There is some, but there was hope for that for the MCAS test, too, so I'm not that optimistic. The A and the S in MCAS stand for assessment system. And back in the early days, they were talking about adding performance assessments to the standardized testing regime, and they really haven't done that. And so we really believe at our school that we've got to take the bull by the horns and do that. And we've gotten really good at developing performance assessments that have really high technical quality that can be that can grade creative thinking, that can grade grade complex student work in standardized ways. So we've gotten really good at developing those kinds of systems, at validating the way that we grade things like projects and essays, at developing descriptions on how to do those projects that are clear to students and that measure the kinds of things that go beyond just the MCAS. So the PARC has some hope of being a more comprehensive system, but we had that hope in the MCAS too. So we are we're sort of holding our cards back a little bit and really making sure we develop our project-based assessment systems more fully.
So, Paul, we've had 15 plus years to fiddle with the MCAS test and shape it a little bit, as much as lawmakers have allowed educators to do so. Is there concern that this PARC test might be less challenging to Commonwealth students, or might actually be a step backwards for Commonwealth students?
I don't share that concern. There was concern that the Common Core was going to be less demanding than let's say the Massachusetts frameworks, and that really has not borne out. The Common Core is more rigorous than our Massachusetts state's frameworks were. It assumes that all kids come to us in sixth grade with their number skills in their back pockets, and that's really not happening yet in this transition from the Massachusetts state framework to the Common Core. So I don't think that it's going to be less rigorous. The questions we have are, is it going to be more creative? Is it going to test some of those creative problem-solving skills that are more aligned with 21st century skills for students?
Right.
That's the real concerns that we have.
Barbara Cotton, as someone who used to teach English at the high school level, who now looking in at the schools and look in what is developed with the testing and the standards, so what's your impression? Are you, and of course, how high we hold our schools when it comes to testing?
I'm glad that I'm not doing formal assessments anymore.
Yeah.
It's interesting. At the Children's Museum, we still do assess our children, and it's actually probably the piece that MCAS doesn't have, that performance assessment. And what we see from a young child who comes in and is studying himself at age one at the train table is the following year coming back to that train table and realizing that there are tracks and he's banging them together and making noises and seeing what happens. And then by the age of three, again, coming back to that table and starting to put the track together and running the train and making the choo-choo sounds. So we get to see the growth that comes along with that. That's something that I didn't have the luxury of doing when I taught ninth grade English. I taught an honors English class, a few of them actually, and I was in the Bronx in New York City for a little while as well. You only get that child for 1 year, and you can see some growth and development in a year, but I think what's most rewarding for me and what I'm doing now at the museum is seeing our children and families come back year after year and watching them grow and seeing how much they've changed over time.
Carol Woodbury, you're the superintendent of schools at the Dennis Yarmouth School District. Now, you've often said that the education system is a reflection of society. I'd like you to talk about that a little bit more.
Well, I think that there are lots of demands, and we were talking about them this morning. Legislators and other lawmakers that think they know what's good for children, and they make laws,
edicts,
and send them to us. And hopefully we have some good lawmakers that do listen often to educators and educational associations that have some experience and background. But, you know, those are the kinds of things that happen to us, and we'd like it to happen with us. One of the things that I will say is I think that there's been some concerted effort on the part of our current commissioner of education for Massachusetts to include the educators. We have several teachers who have gone to work, you know, occasionally for the state to help develop some of the park assessments and to work on some unit plans, some model unit plans, and then have brought them back to the district for, you know, to try them out and see how they work and to go back and give the state feedback. So I think that part's important. Whether or not we'll reach what Paul is talking about with the will they measure creativity and those sorts of things, I mean, I think we're all hopeful for that. I think that was one of the big outcries that we all had when MCAS wasn't a system, as they said it was going to be. And what people sometimes forget is that we actually had curriculum frameworks in all of the other areas, like the arts and world languages, but we're only focused on math, English language arts, and now a little bit on science. What about civics? I'd like our students that graduate from Dennis Yarmouth to be career, college, and civic ready. That's why we do a lot of, you know, service learning projects in our school district. So, you know,
there's just so much to get to. I mean, there
is so
much you want to cover. Are we at a point now where we should be looking to expand the school year?
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Yes. Paul Niles.
Okay, kids.
Paul, should we?
So I would say yes, certainly in some demographics. I would agree with that. I think we really need to look at more more data before such a big commitment gets made. There are some systems and some environments where kids lose progress over the summer and over the weekend, and there are some where you have family structures where kids gain really important kinds of knowledge beyond the school day and the school year. So I think we need more data before we can make that blanket statement. And I think we have to look at doing what we do better during the school day before we can make that kind of a commitment as well.
Okay, understood. Carol, you had to say.
Yeah, I don't disagree with anything that Paul is saying, but I will say that we have one of our innovation schools is an extended school day. In reality, what we've done with adding the additional minutes onto the school day is we've added 17 additional days into the school year over the course of time.
Wow.
So we also have a program at that particular school that does extend into the summer. It's not for everyone. I agree with Paul. There are many parents that are doing all the wonderful things like taking their children to Barbara's Great Museum and doing all those wonderful things with them. But there are many families, especially in our district. We have 45% free and reduced lunch. Many families are just busy trying to get food on the table. And I think school can be a place where kids can, if we do all the right things, that Paul is talking about, it's beyond just the, you know, sit in your desk and work on math problems and all of that. It's doing the kinds of creative things. One of the things that our kids get to do in the summer is in addition to some of their academic work, they're learning to swim. Or they're, we have a bike riding club. We've had some bikes donated and some helmets. So they're getting to be physically active and learning skills like how to play soccer so when they go to middle school they can be on the soccer team. And maybe those are things that they wouldn't have been able to do before.
And Barbara Cotton, real quick, we just have a few, maybe 30 seconds here. Brings up the question, why aren't there children's museums farther down the Cape to help the students in other districts?
Well, you know, children's museums are not easy to run. I'll get calls all the time. How do you start one? And I certainly didn't start this children's museum. And it was started 20 years ago, actually 23 years ago. And it was inspired by the Dartmouth Children's Museum.
So it could happen.
It could very well happen, but I'm busy at the one in Mashpee.
Okay. I want to thank my guests for our discussion today. Carol Woodbury, the superintendent of schools at the Dennis Yarmouth Regional School District. Barbara Cotton, educator and executive director at the Cape Cod Children's Museum in Mashpee. And Paul Niles joining us on the phone. He's the executive director of Cape Cod Lighthouse Charter School. Thank you all very much. It was a great conversation.
Thank you.
I'm Sean Corcoran. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.